Ladies and gents, boys and girls, children of a certain age, no children allowed, technically, but here we are at the Punisher War Journal. We're doing episodes 10 and 11. Was it good? Was it bad? Where is this show going? Let's just see. Devin Higgins, welcome
tonight
back.
Tonight we're going to talk about pumps and not in a shotgun sense.
Okay. Jason Johnson?
We've got the strobe lights and salt rounds ready to go.
Whoo! Eric Scott.
Ain't no party like a John Pilgrim party.
And we're missing Sean Shibley. He's down in action for this week, but he's guaranteed to make an arrival for the next two. So without further ado, Devin, won't you bring us into the train depot so we can get this party started?
All right. We have two episodes to cover. Episode 10, The Dark Hearts of Men, and episode 11, The Abyss. For those of you keeping score, we start episode 10 with where we left off at episode 9 with John Pilgrim meeting his former gang in New York City and getting the fallout from that, both physically and literally, as he spends the majority of the episode trying to heal up and also hallucinating about his wife who is dying back wherever it was they started from. Meanwhile, Frank and Curtis are scouting Valhalla, unaware that Billy has the upper hand by spying on them. And that is flipped against Madani visiting Dr. Dumont and having a long conversation over the span of the episode about the differences between Billy and Frank, which then is utilized as a means by Billy to get to Frank. How he does that is because Frank decides he's going to attack Valhalla, but gets ambushed. He gets beat to a pulp, but not before he manages to take out pretty much all of Billy's henchmen. As he's trying to chase Billy down, he lets off a volley of shots into an upstairs office room and then discovers three dead women on the floor. Meanwhile, his partner Curtis gets one of the mercs that's trying to stop him, and as he is wont to do, trying to keep him alive and fails to do so. And the episode ends with the NYPD finding Frank standing over said dead women, very bloody, very screwed up, and with a gun still in his hand. Jump to episode 11. Frank is being treated in an ambulance on the way to the hospital, still having flashbacks about what had just transpired. While he is on the mend, he gets a visit from the one and only Karen Page. Welcome back. And in the meantime, Amy finds out what has happened to Frank and goes rogue to try and capture or get him loose before any of the hitmen who are trying to get the $5 million bounty find either of them. Madani tells Karen that the evidence surrounding the Valhalla shootout doesn't quite add up, so they're able to do some digging and find out that it wasn't Frank who killed the women, but it was actually somebody else. And then Dumont explains to Billy how it was that she got her scars. It was part of her father's suicide, while Eliza Schultz visits Pilgrim with news that his wife Rebecca has died. She then orders Pilgrim to finish the job for the sake of his kids and their, quote, way of life, end quote. The episode ends with a rogue officer trying to kill Frank and Amy to collect the bounty, only to be stopped by Madani and Karen. They help spring Frank, who is caught at the very, very end by Detective Mahoney, who handcuffs Frank into an ambulance. And that is where we leave it, going into the final two episodes of Marvel's The Punisher.
Okay, so let me just front load this real quick, because this is a reputation thing that I want to put out. I am not, I love The Punisher. I think we all do in our own way, whatever it might be. And sometimes you get into these trappings where you love something and you enjoy it and you're not willing to see potentially the very much the mediocre in it. Episode 10 is the most poorly constructed episode I have ever seen. This A, B, C, D, possibly even an E plot are absolutely throwing me for a loop. And I'm really having a struggle with it. So look, I'm not going to mince it. I'm going to shit on some of these episodes. And these two are going to be crapped on immensely. I love it, but I'm willing to accept and tell you, the listener, that I have problems with it. And I'm not going to try to bounce it and make it sound like it's better than it is. That said, opening remarks.
I kind of agree with you about episode 10 for the most part. There's a couple of good things, like, you know, the Curtis and Frank on the rooftop. That's about it. But yeah, I think it picks up in 11. 11, I guess, kind of starts redeeming and trying to, well, actually it's not even closing any plot holes, plot threads yet. There's still 14 plot threads running through these things, but
there's a bunch of scenes.
But before we get too down on it, I will say I did like the setup to the assault itself.
Okay.
The build up, the planning, minus maybe some of the Billy Overlook stuff, because we can talk about how he's watching them with them completely unaware and whatever. But the setup, you kind of get to see Curtis and Frank and the camaraderie at the same time as the prep for the assault. And of course, once the assault happens and gets past the initial few minutes of it, we can discuss how badly it plays out.
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, we keep talking a lot about how for this series in particular, since we only have 13 episodes to wrap up everything with, and how there are so many plot threads that are still dangling, and how we've been watching it all get woven out from the beginning until now. And I keep thinking about something about how, you know, if this series had been done, you know, 9-10 years ago, even, we'd be looking at the likelihood of having almost twice as many episodes, because old network TV was okay. Yep. Well, if we're going to greenlight a show, you're not just going to give us 13 episodes. You're going to give us 22, 23, 24 a season, which on the one hand gives you more ability to stretch stories out and be more intricate with plot threads and things like that. But then you also have a lot of filler crap that they have to throw in, these little one-off deals just to fill space. And I think the issue with the Punisher is that we're so used to having so much going on in such a compact window that when you have an episode like episode 10, that the structure is just off, that you're bouncing back and forth so much and there's no real consistency to it. It definitely, to me, feels like the weakest sister in the bunch. Mm-hmm. That said, there are elements of it that I will get to that I thought were really good that were ultimately failed by the overall structure of the episode.
I just didn't know, like, when did the whole Valhalla and Billy owning the city, when did that happen? You can't tell me these things. You have to show it to me. And why all of a sudden all these vets are now clamoring together, and now they're running like guard duty. It just mystified me. I feel like I've missed something.
Yeah, I mean, they don't show it. I guess these kind of have to assume that, you know, word's gotten out, or they've been recruiting other like-minded ex-army vets or whatever to join the, whatever you want to call them, a gang.
Well,
a crew, whatever, you know.
And that's why I wanted to think that there was a time jump, at least in my brain, it feels like there is, between episode 8 and 9.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like that while they don't really show it, Billy's crew goes from, you know, the little bit he had at the first job to Valhalla. And it was almost like overnight between 8 and 9, it felt like. So,
yeah, they had to use their money or whatever to buy that warehouse or rent it or whatever. So they had to get enough money from their schemes and then to get their place to recruit more people.
From robbing cashing places?
Yeah, to do robbing banks. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Anyway, I already talked about that before. So.
Right. Well, and if you look at it from the context of how, and obviously that definitely applies in these two episodes, because we'll get to it in episode 11 when we see Karen Page come back in, of how Punisher is tied directly into especially the Daredevil side of the Marvel Netflix universe. Mm-hmm. Okay. Billy Russo is saying, we own the city now. No.
Mm-hmm.
Wilson Fisk would have a word with you about that, because we've seen a guy who goes to the lengths that he wants to own the city. And he did it, frankly, a hell of a lot better. But yeah, there was, it seemed like such a jump from where we left Billy at the midway point of episode 9 when he made that decision and convinced the other guys, okay, let's reinvest this and let's build on what we've done. Okay, I get you there. That is a smart idea. Instead of just going out and blowing it all, looking at it from that standpoint, okay, that tracks. But then going from that and making that quantum leap ahead to, well, now we own everything.
Yeah.
And he's got this whole huge infrastructure under him like he did in season 1. No.
Well,
to your point, to Moses' point, you got to show us. Yeah. You can't just tell us.
To jump ahead too far, but I think that put him in a bind because once they made that jump, now Billy's got a huge crew and is this all-powerful Enterprise. And they wanted to bring it back to just him and Frank. And so a lot of what we're going to gripe on, I think, in 10 is them resetting that stage and clearing his crew out. So now it's just him.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost like, let's build it up to make him a big enemy. But then to keep it personal, we've got to get rid of it all real quick.
Yeah. So before we tear that to shreds, do we want to talk about the pilgrim part at the beginning, like the pilgrim party?
Not really. No.
No.
No, Eric. I want
John
you to talk pilgrim
party. Party.
Yeah. So or just his little meeting with his former gang, where I mean, when he's doing the flashbacks with his wounds in the bed and how he got them, and it's a great headbutt when he got to take the other guy's teeth out of your head.
Ugh.
I mean that was a little too.
I had no problem with the fight. What I had a problem with was taking the opportunity for them to just totally undo all the menace they could with Pilgrim and resetting back to a fallen person. You know what I'm saying? He was this on a mission from God,
mm-hmm.
Soldier. And the commitment is what gave him, I think, a threatening tone. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they just burned all that in that one episode. And that's probably I like that less than I like any of the other stuff in the episode.
Honestly. I think that's a really interesting point is like you've built this character up to be, I was once this, but now I'm a found man and I have, lack of a better term, I have God behind me. And how much stronger could I actually be? And how easy it was for him to fall back to and to fall into old habits.
Because he was more kind of menacing as like he was more quiet and more reserved and more like not mysterious. Well, I guess mysterious sort of, and you know, kind of like menacing without overtly being menacing, you know. Whereas, you know, the fight, okay, whatever, you know, he's defending himself and they show it in, you know, interesting ways to not be boring. But then he like totally falls into the drugs, booze, and hooker, you know, slide or whatever. And
yeah, I mean, well, literally he's getting filleted and thinking about his wife and like, you know, kind of being kind of spiritual about it all at the same time. Like,
yeah, right.
What is going on?
This big soliloquy about brotherhood and whatever was like, I'm like, what? I'm like, yeah. Okay.
That's a way to handle that. Cocaine's a hell of a drug, but geez.
Yeah, I think they were trying to, not to defend my least favorite part, but I think what they were attempting to do was to try to show a mirror between his fall mentally and whatever, and Frank's fall, right? Mm-hmm. Where they broke their mindset. And I get what they wanted. I don't think they succeeded.
Yeah, I mean, it gives a little bit of backstory into Pilgrim, like how he, you know, found Rebecca and like confessed to her, like, this is what I used to be. I'm not him anymore, you know, and like, but then to have him, you know, go back the other way and totally fall apart, you know.
And also, you know, to that point, the one who is getting down and dirty, quite literally, was Frank. I mean, you go back to the fight at the gym with the Russians.
Yeah.
And how he just, he gets everywhere he goes, he ends up coming out and he gets bloody. You know, the shot we all talk about when he goes back to Madani's apartment and he's covered in blood, two thumbs up, I don't care, I did my job. You know, the ultimate Frank Castle meme. But to this point, everything Pilgrim has done has been clean. Every time he killed somebody, came out, he was spotless. And now you see him get taken down. I don't want to say necessarily to Frank's level, but he finds himself where the only option for him is to get down and dirty like Frank does.
He's got no resources.
No, he doesn't. And on the one hand, I like the slight character development involved in that, because we also have him trying to maintain his connection with his wife and doing that via the Schultzes and Eliza Schultz, who we see a lot of in these two episodes. And we see how much she is manipulating the situation and just how out there she is, which now puts Pilgrim in an even more interesting point going into the last two episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think he's like, an interesting character. You know, and the way they frame it here, where, you know, he's so, you know, drugged and coked out of his head that he misses the call probably of his last talk to his wife, which, you know, he didn't get the chance to talk to her before she died. Yeah. So, you know, that adds, I guess, an element to the, you know, whatever tragedy or whatever. But
yeah. I also want to say there's the lest we forget, this episode 10 starts out in a flashback, which we learn it's Madani and Dumont. And like, I appreciate that, but I think that's the part that set this, it was the wrong tone to set up, because I know what we're getting at. We're getting at that Dumont is getting information from Madani in order to get to Frank, but that's not completely clear. So we don't know that essentially the bomb is under the table. I wasn't getting that. So there was no stakes to what this actually meant further down the line. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The structure of it is so murky that we don't have a definitive. The only way we would have known for sure, really, is if they had time stamped each section. If they had said, you know, and literally 10:30 p.m.
Yeah.
Madani walks into Dumont's apartment. 9 o'clock the previous night, Frank and Curtis up on the roof, you know, and having it skip ahead in those ways. Otherwise, they're relying on the viewer to keep pace with it. And again, the structure isn't executed well enough to make those clean transitions understandable. So it's okay, is this happening at the same time? If it's not happening at the same time, who's doing what when? When is this happening relative to when Madani is giving Dumont the information she needs to give to Billy so this can happen? It's so back and forth and so cattywampus that, yeah, you're left kind of going, wait a minute, did that, when, what, huh?
This was almost 2 hours compressed into 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess the other issue I had with that is, you know, Madani was so observant that, you know, she caught Pilgrim watching her at the diner and, you know, circle, you know, jump back on him later. And here she's spilling her guts to Dumont, not realizing she's playing Madani, or I don't know. I didn't quite get it. Was Madani trying to play her? Was she playing them? Like,
Eric, I know what your confusion is. What you're saying is Madani is sharp only when the plot doesn't allow her to be.
Or if they're trying to make her, you know, face her feelings over Billy and what's going on, and maybe that left her not sharp still, but to your point, yeah. I mean, it's the script, but yeah.
But what was good? We've done some crapping. I think we're all getting gearing into the cool part, essentially, which is Frank being Frank and doing some really technically tactical, cool stuff that we'd like to see.
Well, and to an extent, not even just that, but also how Billy counters it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I did think the strongest part for me by far, and it wasn't just because of the blood and guts of it, it was you have Frank in a situation of, you know, he's one man going up against all those guys, and Billy sets the trap, Frank walks into it, and then the way it's executed tactically is really smart. You throw Frank off balance, you throw him off visually, you throw him off hearing, you blast music in his ears. You do everything you can to keep him on the back foot, and as he's on the back foot, you chop him down.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that. We see Frank so sure that he's going to be able to do what he does, and we finally see somebody throw a counter to it going, uh-uh. Now, that said, as we've seen throughout the Punisher, you know, the way he gets beaten down, you have, what, 5, 6, 7 guys? They're wailing on him with crowbars, wrenches, bats, canes. Mm-hmm. I don't care how tough you are. You take a beat like that, you are staying down.
Yeah.
But as we all know, Frank's plot armor is thick enough that if they make it so he can withstand all that and keep going, which, again, being the Punisher, it's what we expect. But there is a fine line that they keep crossing on that where you go, even to a layman, that it just it's too much.
Yeah.
And they address that a little bit when they're in the next episode, when Mahoney's laying out the scene, right? And he's talking it over with Madotti, and he mentions the salt rounds and something that I didn't grasp when we first watched it going through episode 10. And that was the fact that it was intentionally less than lethal from the start.
But yeah, I was thinking, what is his body armor made out of? I mean, if he's taken about this time, like 114 rounds, and he's like, you know, still running around.
It would have been nice to have even Billy say, make sure you're strapped with non-lethal. Make sure whatever, like, however you could say it, it might be one or two sentences just to let us know their intention was not actually to kill Frank. But at the same time, when Billy leaves, he's basically like, break him and then kill him. So
exactly. That's from somebody who has done my share of writing in Am I Dan Moore? No, but that's another discussion for another day. But you can distill it down into 6 words, 5 words, break him, don't kill him.
Right.
It's not about, because, again, he wants to make Frank suffer as Frank made him suffer. That's what this is all about. And to get there, you have to be able to just keep taking pieces out of him. And we see what it does to him. And we see it more in episode 11 as he's trying to get himself back into a position where he can at least survive. You don't have to waste a whole lot of exposition on it. You could have had one of his guys going, you know, why don't we just kill him?
Yeah.
You know, with the plan, we could kill him really easily. And Billy can just say it. We're here to break him.
Yeah. On the artistic level, I like the idea of the strobe lights and the music and that sound design, because it gave you kind of that parallel of what it's like to be in Billy's head and juxtapose that onto Frank and had to set him on his heels. I'd like that. That was extremely like effective for me. I could get into that.
Yeah. I mean, I know we're going to rag on this later, but I mean, it's a great set piece. I mean, you know, how Frank gets set up, you know, with them on the, you know, Billy watching Frank and Curtis on the roof while they're having their bonding time. And like, you know, who watches the watchers, you know, but that's cool.
Eric, and that's what it is. It's set pieces. I mean, that's the whole episode is great set pieces.
Yeah, the whole, you know, Frank gets ambushed, you know, gets beat to hell, but then, you know, he rises from the dead and, you know, beats everybody up and escapes, sort of. You know, it's great, a great set piece.
The logistics Curtis's.
And the reality of, yeah, but the reality of what happens or why it happened, which we'll get into it probably here in a minute, just makes no sense. Well, doesn't make much sense.
And while we're on positives, I will say, and this is kind of jumping towards a little more to the end of this episode, but the Curtis part where he's actually forced to respond, and you see him try to, after he shoots the guy, try to save him, because that's what he is, right? He was the medic. He's it was Curtis being Curtis. And I thought that was probably my favorite part of the episode, was seeing his response where he got put in a situation where he had to act like Frank, and then immediately switching back to his core and trying to undo the damage and save the person.
And there were consequences that happen in the next episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everyone's broken in this episode. You know, Frank gets broken by Billy. Curtis gets broken by what he did to the guy. You know,
gets broken by Dumont.
Yep. Yeah.
Right. But out of all of them, to me, Curtis is the most consistent from where we left him in episode 9 through to episode 11. Because he's still maintaining his moral compass. Mm-hmm. The conversation he has with Frank about Billy when Frank admits that, yeah, he's got a blind spot. When he finally acknowledges that, which is not something that you hear Frank Castle ever really admit to, you know, because he's so laser focused on a target that to him to concede that he has a blind spot for the person he's going after, not an easy admission to make, but he can make that to Curtis and Curtis gets it. Yeah. And then Curtis turns around and to what we were saying earlier about the whole idea of, well, how did Billy manage to put all this together so quickly? Again, he manages to, it's given to us in one sentence. You know, these guys want to be a part of something and Billy is giving that to them.
Yeah.
Period, done, over. You don't have to expound on it. And I credit the writers in being able to at least get one of the characters right in an otherwise badly constructed episode. And I'm glad it was Curtis, because Curtis keeps reminding us why we like him so much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because he goes completely against the grain of who Frank is, and that doesn't make him a terrible person. It makes Frank a better character for having him as a counterpoint and somebody he can push against and somebody he can lean on. But if this episode is, that's easily the biggest positive for me, is that we still got to see Curtis being Curtis, and that consistency is maintained through the slipshod structure of the episode.
Mm-hmm. Are we okay with how Frank got broken? Again, this is not negative nor positive. I just didn't see it indicative of his character that, you know, he made a spray of shots thinking it was Billy and a few others, but in technically, it was these prostitutes that got killed, and that somehow messed Frank up.
I mean, I do buy it, because we've been talking about, you know, Frank has his code, you know, and even Madani talked to DeMont about, you know, and Mahoney. It's like, Frank has a code, you know. And so, I mean, I do kind of buy it that, you know, Frank is punishing the guilty, you know, that he's helping the innocent or the people that were victimized, you know, by attacking the people that victimized them or the people that did the wrong. And for him to, you know, on purpose or by accident kill innocents. Yeah. I mean, that I can see it hitting him where, I guess, you know, his comic book code is, you know.
Okay.
I can buy it in the moment when he's been through the disoriented gauntlet and they put everything they could to him and he's barely standing and he thinks he's done it and all that kind of stuff. I can buy it in the moment. For the lasting, and again, not to get too far into 11, but the fact that the lasting impact of it, I struggle with that because I would think that Frank has enough capability to step back and think about, I did my best to see this coming. How could he trust Billy to have actually not set him up? You know what I'm saying? I mean, there seems to be no level of suspicion of Billy that I would expect Frank to have.
And I think to an extent, there is the reality of when you have such a strict moral code as Frank does, and then all of a sudden you see that get turned on its ear, as we see at the end of episode 10. There is a moment in episode 11, and as we're transitioning into it anyway, we might as well get into it, which leads into easily my favorite part of episode 11, which is Karen frickin' Page. God, it is good to see her again.
About time.
Agreed.
And
yeah, waiting for that. Yeah.
There is a moment in his conversations with Karen where he says flat out, it's not that he didn't know that they were there. It's that he didn't care. After everything that had happened in getting jumped in everything in Valhalla, that whole sequence, that whole set piece, as Frank is running purely on autopilot, probably running on adrenaline and just so singularly focused on trying to stop Billy that he lets it rip. And we see, and because we don't just get Bernthal grunt, we get Bernthal roar in that sequence, remember? And that's when you know that Frank is totally off the chain. And when you see that really settling into him at the hospital afterwards, when he's talking to Karen, and anybody who has had to deal with survivor's guilt or PTSD to various extents, when you've had that moment where you have done something and obviously not on a scale like this, it could be something fairly mundane, but when the rationale kicks in that you're the one who is responsible for it, and when you really peel it back and try and figure out the hows and the whys for you let it happen, and you know instinctively a part of you basically said, I don't care,
yeah,
or I didn't care, you know, that's a big deal. And it's not an easy admission to make, especially when you're Frank Castle and you don't let yourself be vulnerable like that. You know, the conversations he had with Karen in episode 11 juxtaposed against everything that was wrong in episode 10 to me was some of the strongest stuff in the entire series to this point, in my opinion. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, and I think in, like, especially episode 11, it seemed like everything, except, you know, about halfway through, everything was contained down to a few set pieces. We had the hospital, a little bit of let me see. Well, we had a little bit
of the trailer.
Yeah.
The morgue. Yeah.
Yeah. Which was interesting. That was a nice setup. And then pay off later. I was really not expecting the whole creepy Ed Moore guy and his favor that Karen gives him. That was not expected at all. And it was actually kind of funny.
It was a little bit of levity in, again, otherwise a very dark and twisted season. And as soon as I saw it, I remember I was like, only in Frank's world would somebody like this guy exist?
Yeah,
that and the clown with the balloons. That was the other part of that episode. That
the
moment of levity.
Yeah, we wouldn't see Ed the morgue attendant in Daredevil. He wouldn't be in Luke Cage. He wouldn't be in Jessica Jones. Even though in Jessica Jones, somebody like that would not seem entirely out of place either. But in Frank's world, there's a spot for Ed the creepy morgue attendant.
I thought he wanted to date. I was positive that's what it would be. It would be something to the effect of, okay, so will I see you this Friday? Something to that effect. Lo and behold, he wears Crocs, but he really likes women's shoes.
And yeah, happened to be her size.
As soon as we saw Karen walking down the hallway in her bare feet, I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, I
was just like, not okay. Ready. It was the most Oceans. Like, I call it Ocean 666, like, breakout plot I've ever seen. It was really actually very well set up and organized. I felt like I was watching a Soderbergh type situation.
And yeah, Soderbergh decided he was going to do The Punisher.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. You know, Karen's a reporter. You know, you do favors with people to get in, you know, to get the tips, the inroads with things. So, okay, this guy wants her shoes. Okay, here you go. Can we get in the board now? Thanks. You know,
I was a reporter for 10 years, Eric. What are you insinuating?
That you know things.
What kind of shoes are you wearing right now?
Yeah.
So I have bare feet, but I will not comment more.
Speaking of her being a reporter, I did want to point out that was one moment of confusion I had at the beginning of this episode. And I'm assuming she was just using it as a way to get in. But when she first appears, she plays up the Nelson and Murdoch angle. And I was like, wait, are we back in, you know, when she's still with the firm? And where did this fit in the timeline? And then later she gets referenced to the Ed about being an investigator. And I'm like, well, okay, so that was just a ploy. That threw me off a little bit.
Yeah, they never really, and I should have gone back and looked because I'm not entirely sure either, but I believe this comes after the final season of Daredevil.
I can only assume.
So, right. Well, you could look at it that way, or you could look at it that Karen is smart enough that she has enough street smarts like Amy does to know that if she can use either one to get an advantage, then she'll use it. Which,
yeah, or that's her role now as part of Nelson and Murdoch, is she's like their investigator that goes out and helps gather evidence or run down leads or whatever. So, you know, but she's also using her news creds to, you know, help with that.
Yeah,
that's a good point. I need to rewatch Daredevil season 3. That's what I'm taking away from that.
The one thing that kind of threw me, and maybe it's distance between shows and when I'm watching, but I had actually kind of forgot about the whole $5 million bounty and what that might do. And especially when we have, I thought it was just some like fake cop coming in to Frank's room. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was positive. It was like, it's like, okay, this guy recognizes him as a cop, but there's probably a lot of cops and he wouldn't know necessarily who's filling in for who. But the whole scene, I thought very interesting. However, it played extremely quick, was that Frank was so easy because of the damage he had done to innocent people. He was willing to just die and allow this guy, instead of getting shot, he has a syringe. Again, I think it's kind of a weird weapon, but it, like, what it was striving for, I could get behind, at least that Frank was like, I'm done. There's nothing more I can do. At the same time, like, Billy's still alive, dude. What, I mean, you're not out. You don't have to die.
Yeah, he's just at that point checked out because, you know, his world's been shattered, his code's been broken. He's just like, okay, screw it, I'm done. Even though, you know, we're all like, no, you idiot.
Is it Frank's kryptonite? But, yeah. Like, innocence dying by his hand? That's his kryptonite?
Well, yeah, I guess you have to have something to your Achilles heel, right?
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean, if you go by his mission statement of I'm going to punish the people who deserve to be punished, then to turn that and suddenly say, okay, well, that applies to everybody. You know, it's the thin veneer that makes him rationalize why he's able to do what he does. And when, after episode 10, and you see him grappling with the reality of that is all gone. And again, I go back to that conversation he had with Karen after he wakes up, and he breaks down because it's not just that he's talking about, you know, what he thought he did, but also how his whole mindset in regards to his family and how, you know, he couldn't save his daughter and he couldn't save his son and how they looked when they died. Mm-hmm. and all of that and all of that stuff kind of just, it's been, all of that has been sitting there right alongside all the rage and everything that makes the Punisher that we knew was going to be coming out at some point in this season. It, everything leads to that. But we have that pause before we can really get there after he lets it out for a little while in storming Valhalla. Now he has to rebuild it back up. And then once he gets the, albeit rather convenient, explanation that it wasn't him that killed those three women, then he's able to switch that back around and go, okay. Mm-hmm. And lay it out to Karen in the very bluntest of terms when he's talking about why he has to protect Amy, which is why he has to get out of there, because this guy came looking for him and he got that close and he almost let him. Now, if I don't do something now, whoever's coming after this guy to get that bounty from us, they're not going to be able to, he can't do anything handcuffed to a hospital gurney.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so, at what point did Billy call Frank? Was it after Frank knew he didn't kill them or before?
No, before? It was before.
Okay. Yeah, which even further sets Frank off. It's like, you know, because now Billy's doing the same thing to Frank that Frank did to Billy. It's like, I want you to suffer every day. You're going to think about what you did. You know, you're going to be broken the rest of your life like I was, you know. Like,
yeah. Did Eliza tell Pilgrim where Frank was, or is that just common knowledge because of the radio that, you know, everybody knew Frank Castle was in the hospital?
They didn't,
probably common knowledge, I would think, or at least if you had police scanners or,
yeah. Yeah, probably with the connections they have, he probably found out that way.
Okay.
But she did not implicitly come out and tell him where he was.
Yeah, just to go finish the job, not go finish the job at, you know, Mercy General or, you know.
Yeah.
But also cover up my vein that is bulging.
Good God.
That was the weirdest thing, was it not?
I have
a little distracting, I think. Yeah.
It took a minute before I was like, if that was a makeup effect, that was damn good.
But I was expecting her to go into zombie mode.
Yeah. Which is, it's funny because Annette O'Toole, the first time I ever saw her, she was the original Lana Lang in the original Lana Lang in Superman 1 with Christopher Reeve. He was Clark Kent's girlfriend in Smallville.
Holy
crap. So I remember seeing her 40 years younger, and albeit a very striking woman back then, still now. But you see, I thought about that. I'm like, wow. When it hit me that that was her, I was like, oh my God.
Like, she's got the virus.
She's taking a turn.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, either that's some good age makeup, or it's like they made that, I don't know, yeah, but it was definitely like, I just kept staring at the veins down her face while she's, you know, trying to get Pilgrim to, you know, snap out of it and get back in the game. I'm like, that's taking me out of the whole scene.
Yeah, it's just like, it's like, is this the right composition that you all wanted? Like, you know, I could see where, like, we really want to get this, you know, an angle where Pilgrim's on the ground and she's talking to him, but obviously she's bent over and, you know, her blood's pumping and stuff like that. And, you know, just on a normal physiological level, I'm just like, guys, I really like what you're like. If I was the producer and just say, I know what you're going for. In this case, let's have her stand up. It's not doing us any justice because this is really distracting.
Honestly, I don't know if it would have made much of a difference. And if you look at the way the scene is shot and the coverage that they have on her, again, we are getting glimpses into Frank's world. And in the same way, Ed, the creepy morgue attendant, works, having a female character being so self-righteous and dictating what Pilgrim does, basically directing him as a mechanism to go, no, you will go do this. Not because my husband is telling you, not because the male-dominated patriarchal character in this dynamic is telling you, I'm telling you.
Oh, Devin's getting woke. Uh-oh. Look out.
And I was just going to say, I think that the one thing I really did like about that scene that didn't pay off, but there was a moment where she's talking to John Preacher and he says, Frank didn't do anything to me. And I really thought maybe that was going to be a pivot point where he just declares war after his wife's death on them, the Schultzes. But and that would be interesting to have both sides coming back in on the Schultzes in the finale two episodes. But we didn't get that. He ended up going back after Frank after she told him to. So,
well, yeah, he's
gone back into holy warrior mode. So he's back, you know, right, or at least I'm just going to get the job done and go back to my kids. Cause that's the only thing I got left now, you know, so.
Right, but you see the way she manipulates that situation where you see, to your point, Jason, of how Pilgrim very frankly says, you know, yeah, this guy hasn't done anything to me. He fails to, at the stage of where he is at, being able to see the logic of carrying on is eroding. Now that his wife is dead, all of his motivation to finish his work is gone. And Eliza Schultz, like a pile driver, is bashing him over the head going, no, no, you will do what I tell you for me and my interests, which will ultimately help you and what you have left. So go get him.
Yeah, because Pilgrim still has no clue why he's after Frank. Just they have something. Amy has something that the Schultzes don't want to get out, but he doesn't know what it is. He's just doing it because they helped him get his life back together. And, you know, now, yeah, he's got, like he said, he's got nothing left except maybe his kids, but still, like, there's no fire now. It's just like, just get my thing done and I'm going home. Like, I just want to get done with this. I don't care, you know.
Right. Which leads into one angle that we haven't really touched on yet, which is the aftermath of Billy and Dumont after he gets back. And because, like, what we see with Pilgrim and how he's got to keep going, you know, Dumont is formulating the exit strategy for trying to get her and Billy out so they can go have their twisted, dysfunctional relationship, whatever it's going to be. And there is a moment there that I thought was interesting where we see Billy, and it's after he makes the phone call,
mm-hmm.
where she's saying, you know, I thought you'd be happier because you've won. You've got what you wanted. And he tells her that, you know, it's the problem with getting what you want is that when you ultimately get it, it's more disappointing than the actual process of getting it. It's you've got it right in your hand. And now that you have it, you go, is that it?
Well, and the idea when he was saying, like, you know, of all the things that you have done in speaking of Dumont, that you might resent me, you know, when you look back on it all, you might resent me for the things that you've done to help me. That was interesting.
Because he kind of throws it back on her. It's like, you know, well, this is your plan to kill these three women. So it's kind of on you as he's putting the bullet casings on the table that he killed
them with. Yeah, I thought the bullet casings were good foreshadowing. Yeah.
Well, and it was even as a psychological tool. You know, it's one thing to say it. It's another thing to take those casings and put them down right in front of her and go, the only reason why these are empty is because of you.
Yeah.
Now, how are you going to deal with that? How do you compartmentalize that? And that psychologically was an interesting turn because we haven't seen that side of Dumont yet and how much that may impact her now that she gets the full scope of how far she's in on this.
Mm-hmm.
You juxtapose that against her explanation finally opening up to Billy about how she got her scars. And I thought that was a little telling as well.
Yeah.
You know, she's still gone full Harley Quinn. There's no disputing that. But I like the explanation and the way she conveys it to Billy, because at first he's standoffish about it. Oh, well, you know, you said this about me. You said this about another guy. Well, who's the other guy? Do you have the same? And he's thinking linearly in terms of, oh, well, this was another love interest that, for whatever reason, isn't in the picture anymore. And what she explains is it was her dad, and then explains why.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, well.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing a lot of character development that's very interesting in this episode. I'm thinking to myself, you know, this is episode 11, right, guys?
Yeah, you're running out of time.
There's only two more to go, and there's still 47 plot threads. We got to wrap up here in 2 hours.
And I think if they'd have done that setup with her, the explanation two episodes earlier, and gotten you before the conversation with her and Madani, where she kind of manipulated Madani, I think it would have made her more sympathetic at the earlier point and had you more invested in her character. At this point, she's already fully, like you said, gone full Harley. And so you lose that sympathetic link that I think you would have had earlier in the season with that backstory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And go ahead, Dana.
In thinking about it, it's okay. Again, we have 13 episodes to try and get all of this stuff into. If you look at it, we've spent all this time with the A arc of Billy, Frank, Madani, and all that. Underlying that, you have the Schultzes, Pilgrim,
and
Amy, and the Russian connection, and all that stuff. Okay. I would proffer to say if you took like the middle three episodes, all the stuff that they spent all that time focusing on the Russians and all that, if you had shrunk that down, gave us maybe 20% of it, and spent the bulk of that time fleshing all of this stuff out in that space, then you wouldn't see them having to cram so much into these penultimate two episodes before we get to the last two.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be playing catch up on that. I think we certainly would have had a better episode 10, I believe, but it also would have given them more leeway to intersperse this stuff in a more organic way.
Yeah, because the whole thing, see if this makes sense to you guys. So Dumont's been wanting her and Billy to, like, you know, take the money and just go off somewhere to another island, you know, island or another country, or just to get away from things.
Sure.
But they can't because, you know, Frank will still find them. So she comes up with the plan to, like, you know, crush Frank's, you know, moral code here by having, you know, innocent people killed. So at what point did those three prostitutes die? When did Billy kill them? Did he set his guys up to like basically to wipe out all his crew, so that then it'd just be him and her left, and Frank's in prison or messed up for the rest of his life, and then they could escape. Is that the plan?
Pretty much.
At what point did Frank did Billy set his whole crew up?
Yeah, if I'm a member of Billy's crew, I have got to, like, now I'm like rethinking everything that he does, because essentially he sees his entire crew as expendable.
And how did he know to, okay, go ahead and beat Frank up so bad, but don't kill him yet. And he runs away to kill the prostitutes, knowing that, oh, Frank's just going to mow his guys down because there's 15 of them and one of him. And like, what? Like, I'm just trying to explain.
That.
Yeah, I'm saying he killed him earlier, but then I guess he's assuming that Frank would just wipe the floor with his people, which that shows you how good people he has, apparently. But what? I don't get that middle part of the plan. I get how they're trying to set him up and whatever, but the whole how they executed, I'm confused.
Well, and again, that's part of the convoluted structure of episode 10, where they had a flashback in there, or they had a sequence, and it was really brief, where you saw Billy and the one guy he got out with take the three prostitutes down.
Yeah.
And I think it was right before, if I remember it right, it was as Dumont was explaining after meeting with Madani how to get to Frank, and as the narration is going on, you flash to when Billy is firing on the three women, and then you jump forward to when the police come in and Frank is standing there with the gun over the women. I would need to go back and watch that to confirm, and it's been a week, but I think that is how that happened in my head canon.
Yeah, I mean, this is all plot shortcuts, because, you know, the police show up, you know, of course, you know, screen time, like, you know, 5 seconds after he's standing there in shock that he killed three people. So, like, did they call him ahead of time and say, hey, the Punisher is here, we got red-handed, and then, you know, mow the women down, Frank's off getting beat up, and then Billy leaves and starts thinking, okay, 2 minutes from now, they're all going to die, and Frank will come over, and, you know.
Right. I do have a question, which is...
We have answers.
Well, I'd like to think so. How do you guys think, if there had been a Punisher season 3, how do you think his relationship with Karen would have shaken out? Because there is a lot intimated in this episode about what Karen sees in Frank and what Frank sees in Karen.
Yeah.
And I would have been really curious, had we gotten a third season, what would they have done with that relationship?
I think we all can get tied up in the idea of them having some sort of relationship, the will they, won't they scenario. At least from my perspective, that seems to be, they are inextricably linked and in a very interesting and tumultuous way. However, I can't ever accept it to happen. It doesn't track for me if, you know, they're on the back 40 watching their kids grow up. You know, that just, it just doesn't, well, it's not going to fly, but I like the idea of it, but I don't want it.
And there's two pieces to that. One is Frank's statement to her that he doesn't want it, right? He's now accepted that he has a mission and he doesn't want happiness. So Frank's already moved past it, I think, whether she feels that way or not. So that's my Punisher take on it. The second thing I would have to say is, based on, you know, her involvement in the Daredevil franchise, I don't think that if Punisher season had continued and Daredevil had continued, I don't think the Daredevil side would have allowed it to happen in the Punisher, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Plus the whole thing of anytime Frank gets close to somebody, that person either dies or gets horribly maimed, like the bartender woman, his wife.
And see right there.
So then they could play off that. But, you know, maybe, you know, she gets more imperil, she gets kidnapped, she gets you, whatever. They could go down that route.
He was almost willing to kind of settle down in Ohio with her. I mean, it almost felt like that was where it was going.
Until he got pulled back into, you know, and now he's becoming the Punisher. You know, he's realizing now that, you know, this is the way, this is my purpose. You know, this is my, you know, my new career path. And, you know, I don't have any time for, you know, attachments or, you know, not weaknesses, but things to help, to limit, to be used against him. You know, he has to be fully alone, you know, committed to the cause.
Yeah, I mean, that was, and I'm in agreement with you guys on that. But again, they would try to cram so much into 40 odd minutes of TV time. And you go back to season one where we had the conversations with Frank and Karen when Karen was trying to step in and help him out. And obviously we have Daredevil season two where Frank is introduced to Karen and we see the formation of their relationship. Long term, would it work? Absolutely not. There are two fundamentally traumatized, I don't want to say broken people, but they are very damaged in their own way.
Yeah.
And clearly Karen does not want to see Frank, how she views it, throw his life away. While Frank, as Eric alluded to, realizes his purpose and says, no, this is, I'm not throwing it away. I'm using it for something that works for him. And there's a, again, another quick little throwaway line that he asks her, you know, so does Matt Murdock know you're here? And when she doesn't say anything, he goes, nope, that's what I thought. And says to her, you know, he's good people. Don't throw that away from me. And you see how Karen reacts to it, and she doesn't see it that way. But again, had we gotten to season three, I really would have liked to have seen what the next step would have been. Would it have been romantic? I don't think so either. I think it's much more fraternal and how they both look after each other because they both see the value in what they both do. But that is one of those dangling fish hooks from how this being canceled, it's going to leave me going forward.
I would have much rather seen Frank go somewhere else, off into some other country and get involved into a situation like completely outside of New York, outside of the United States. It was just to do something completely different.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of directions it could have gone. You know, if you could go full circle with this and have it start with him back in that bar,
no,
you know, a couple months later with the bartender, you know, and him trying to reconcile that. I mean, there's a lot of different directions they could have gone in, but, you know, it's, there was a lot of untended ground that they could have brought up had we gotten a third season.
Yeah.
And obviously we need to still see how season two ends. But, you know, to me, that was one of the highlights of, again, having somebody like Karen Page to be able to be brought back and have that aspect of Frank's relationship that we've seen through Daredevil and season one of Punisher and kind of get that revisited a little bit.
Yeah. And of course, this all ends up with Frank getting caught up by Mahoney and locked into an ambulance, and Mahoney's going to take him in via ambulance.
Poor Mahoney.
If what we could had possibly a season, go wrong with that, right?
If we had a season three, I'm sure episode one would have been him putting in his retirement pay.
Well, you know, because think about it. We've seen Mahoney's journey for many different. What was he in Luke Cage?
No, he was in Daredevil.
Yeah, I was just wondering where he lined up. We started in Daredevil, and here we are. You know, he's a detective now. But like his full arc has been really kind of amazing when you think about like as a very much a side character, but integral. He can interlink as we go in these seasons.
Yeah,
The only thing that was missing from that was having Karen bring his grandmother cigars. That was really what was missing from this episode.
Yeah.
I think he did appear in Luke Cage, didn't he? Wasn't he talking to Missy Knight one time, I think?
Yeah, he did. He's one of three characters that was in multiple series. It was him, Karen Page, and Claire Rosario Dawson as the night nurse.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, when we see him in Daredevil, he's a grunt. He's a foot soldier. And it's because of what happens at the end of season one of Daredevil that he gets bumped up to being a detective.
Yeah.
And now he's gone from that through Daredevil, through Luke Cage, and now through Punisher. And I'm sure, I mean, he's got to be sitting there. What the hell is going on? Why is this happening to me?
Why are you in my precinct? Why can't you go somewhere else in the five boroughs? Why do you got to hang out in my area?
I mean, good God, if he ever sees Madani on a vacant street corner again, I'm sure the first thing he's going to think of is, do I have my Kevlar on?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, he has been, for a secondary character who's been put through the ringer, you know, I genuinely feel for Mahoney, and which is great because at the end of it, he finally just, you're not the only one who gets to be crazy. Yep. It's like, enough of this shit.
Yep.
I got my man. We're out. You're done, Madani. I'm putting him in the car. We're going downtown. We're done.
And fade to black.
Well, and will they make it or not?
There's no chance. Something yeah, exactly. Will go awry. We fully know that.
Frank's so, not going to jail. We can guarantee that. Yeah.
Yeah. So to cap off, now, listeners, we have not just been watching Punisher. We're obviously watching other things during this time of pandemic. And I thought the guys didn't know anything about me bringing this up, but I thought I would put a spin on it. What are like the one to two things that are new-ish that you have been watching? I'll tell you what I've thrown down. One movie, one TV show. The movie that I've seen on Netflix that I really enjoyed as a guy who really loved Heat is Den of Thieves, which I highly recommend. Just check it out. It's got a great Heat-like gun battle. And TV show, I've already watched all eight of them, is Solar Opposites. It's the creators of Rick and Morty doing their own thing. Gents, what's been in your COVID queue?
As somebody who, like you, loves Heat, I will need to go check out Den of Thieves based on that recommendation alone. So for me, I've actually been revisiting the Amazon show Bosch.
Okay.
Season 6 came out at the beginning of this month. I binge watched all of that because it's really well done. Of course, if you're familiar with Bosch, it's based off the Michael Connelly detective novels, of which she's written like 30 of them. They've done 6 seasons on Amazon. They've already greenlighted a 7th. I do know they have confirmed it's going to be the last one.
Ooh.
But they are 10 episode seasons. And again, as we're talking about Netflix shows and how we've seen over the last couple of years, the condensation of content and how that impacts how stories get told, you know, the writers for Bosch have to take these 300-400 page books and condense them down into 10 episode series that intersperse with different novels that Conley has written in different timelines. The acting is really solid. It's all shot in LA, which the books are set in, so everything is real, and it's just really well done. If you like crime fiction, not on a similar scale to Punisher, but if that's your bag, nothing better than Bosch right now.
Nice.
For me, I guess the last film we saw last weekend was on Netflix, the Six Underground, the Ryan Reynolds like action kind of Mission Impossible kind of movie.
Oh yeah. Okay.
I think he's finally found his niche as like that you know action smartass kind of hero, like between Deadpool and this guy in Six Underground, like with the quips and the action. I think he's found his niche. So it was a pretty good movie.
Did Michael Bay do that?
Yeah.
Okay. It felt like it, so I wouldn't. But
yeah,
I wouldn't
it had the you know Transformers, everything explodes. Yeah.
I was like,
wow, this is like a Michael Bay film. And at the end, a Michael Bay film. Oh, there you go. Okay.
Yes.
I was just saying, I know he was involved in it. I wasn't sure if he directed or produced it, but I know he had a hand in it.
And then TV series, just kind of, I guess, all of the, exception of the Legends of Tomorrow, all the CW hero shows have wrapped up kind of disappointingly. So I am really looking forward to hopefully what is going to be like, hopefully a more lighter, more not depressing, serious, grim superhero show next week. Stargirl is starting up. So I'm really hoping that's going to be kind of like to revive the CW superhero franchise.
Yeah, I've heard of that. That'd be very
good. Because it looks more fun, upbeat, funny, not as serious, because one of her main villains in this one is apparently a sportsmaster.
A guy
that runs around with like baseball bats and like sporting equipment as his weapons. So I mean, that's got to be fun. I love the character. It's a comic book. I want to see this in real life now. This could be good. But I want to see how that works out.
Casey Jones 2.0.
Oof.
Yeah. Well, and then I guess, and then, cause going forward in the future, they just announced the new Star Trek Captain Pike series, which I can't wait for, because I thought Anson Mount was the star, breakout star of season two of Discovery. You know, everyone's wanting the Pike show. You know, hashtag they built the sets of the Enterprise. I can't wait. I'm fully looking forward to that.
This is the first time hearing about this. I can't believe they're doing yet another Star Trek.
Yeah, it's going to be a whole, there's a couple animated series coming out. There's Discovery's coming out. Michelle Yeoh's Section 31 series. So it's going to become the tentpole of CBS All Access or whatever it becomes with this Viacom merger. But
yeah,
I guess that means I actually have to watch season two of Discovery now. I still have put that off.
I don't think you do.
Yeah, the whole Captain Pike and Number One and Spock from the original series, that's the core. I mean, I'm looking forward to that. I really thought they knocked that out of the park with the characterizations of that.
Well, Jason, it's up to you.
Go ahead. Well, so being stuck, quarantined home with the kids, I've been doing a lot of What's New Scooby-Doo and Clone Wars. I think those are the two TV shows I've actually been able to watch. So I'm definitely taking recommendations at this point because help.
Yeah, how's Clone Wars season 7 and 8, the last two, or 6 and 7?
So I have a confession to make, and that's that I completely skipped Clone Wars when it came out. So I'm actually working my way back through on season 2 now. So I don't know yet.
Okay.
And I believe that has ended as well. I think this last season was it. But yeah, I'd heard really good things about it. I had started watching a couple episodes back in the day. And I think it was Star Wars Rebels. I had watched a couple that the guy who did Samurai Jack did the animation for, but never got back around to those either.
Yeah, I highly recommend Rebels. I really love that one. It was one of the it was one of those where the first season was kind of like, I'm not really sure. And then as it went, it got really good. So, but yeah, I've gone back to Clone Wars to try to see if I can, just because I've heard such good stuff about the last season. So,
oh, speaking of CW, some new breaking news today. The boy who played Barry Allen as a boy, fentanyl overdose, dead.
Oh. Wow. He was like, what?
16. 16.
Yeah. Damn.
Damn.
So, I'm good for bringing everything down.
Yeah.
But it just popped in my head. I couldn't help it. But gents, we've given a little preview to things that you can watch while you're at home. Any final thoughts?
And now we have to wrap up Punisher season 2 in 80 minutes or less.
That's right. I think
so
we
back
can
to
do
the
it.
Lighter side of things. Back to Punisher. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Let's see.
So yeah, how we're going to wrap up 46 plot lines in two episodes, I guess. And if it's like the usual, where it's like they wrap it all up in episode 12, and 13 is like the denouement. Where
yeah,
they
I don't
go
know.
Off in the sunset. Probably not. They got too much to. Well, I hope to do it justice and close it out in 2 hours versus an hour, and then have an hour of fluff at the end. So hopefully,
we won't put the negative waves out in the atmosphere. The weird
it's
thing
all good.
Is,
they're going to bring it home. It's going to be awesome.
Oh,
leave
absolutely.
Us wanting season 3, which we're not going to get.
Yep. At least it's good. The
go
best.
On a good note.
The best. All right, gents. Thank you so much for joining us. Ladies and gents out there in audio land, we appreciate you. We love you. Stay safe. Stay home. Unless you have to, just be careful. Put a mask on. Be nice. We'll see you later.